It is Monday, April 15th, 2013, and this is episode 14 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and don't represent those of my employer. First, I'd like to express my condolences and sympathies and thoughts to those people who were impacted by the events today in Boston. The first story I want to talk about tonight actually has to do with Vudu. Vudu is a video on demand service, and they lost a hard drive apparently in an office burglary. And what this shows me is that you really need to think about encrypting your drives, whether or not you think that system is actually likely to leave your premise or not. And when you look at Data Loss DB, as I did a couple weeks ago for some research at work, you'll notice that, especially in the PHI space, there's an inordinate number of data loss events that happen from systems being stolen out of an office. I think we're really getting to the point now where hard drive encryption is just table stakes. It's similar in concept to antivirus. You wouldn't have a workstation without antivirus, and you shouldn't have a workstation without an encrypted hard drive. And I can hear lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth because, you know, we need to evaluate the risk and apply this control based on what the kind of data that's being stored on these workstations. But you know, the reality is, in the workstation context, and really even in the server context, you aren't ever actually going to have a good handle on what really gets stored on those things. All right, next story is that this past Tuesday was Microsoft Tuesday and also Adobe Tuesday. Normally I don't mention those, but I thought this was particularly interesting. There were a number of remote code execution vulnerabilities and also some local privilege escalation vulnerabilities, which when you chain those together, these really start to spell trouble. And my general observation is that a lot of organizations don't treat local privilege escalation problems very seriously. But when you have someone who is able to get a toehold on a system, they provide a really easy means for an attacker to quickly become root and really have their way with the system. And I guess my point there is that applying patches to prevent remote code execution vulnerabilities really isn't completely adequate. You need to really think through the entire chain of events that would lead to a system being compromised. And to me, that really says that privilege escalation bugs need to be patched quickly, as well as remote code execution vulnerabilities. In a somewhat strangely related story, there are 51 weeks left of Windows XP support, so start planning accordingly if you haven't already done so. I know it's a pain in the butt, but you have to swallow hard and start migrating if you haven't done that already. And I might add, I think you'll like Windows 7 a lot better. I'm not sure about Windows 8 yet. It seems a little wonky to me. I sincerely hope Microsoft backs off just a little bit on the whole application deal. The next story is about the disconnect between the hype around cyber intrusions and cyber losses of intellectual property to organizations, particularly in the U.S., and the resulting furor around that in industry circles and indeed in government circles, and what's being reported in SEC filings. So if you look at the SEC filings, you will see that organizations now are indeed reporting instances of cyber attack activity, but they're generally, with very few exceptions, reporting that there was no material impact to their company as a result of those activities. And so on the one hand, we have a lot of activity being whipped up in Congress because of the terrible cyber threat that is bearing down on us. And at the same time, we have our companies who are the apparent victims of these attacks saying that, well, it really wasn't a big deal. So somebody's really not telling the truth there. Or at least maybe not the whole truth. So this basically says that either incidents are being dramatically underreported in SEC filings, which is now the guidance. I realize I don't think it's a hard requirement. Or there's a bit of overplaying of the threat for different business or political reasons. I suspect the truth is somewhere in the middle, as it usually is. All right, the next story comes from FireEye's report on advanced threats. Their first point is that malware continues to be the weapon of choice. Now, having said that, I'm not entirely sure how many other alternative weapons there might be, but apparently malware is indeed the weapon of choice, at least among the advanced attackers, and probably even the non-advanced attackers. Their next point is that different industries are targeted in different cycles. And some of those cycles seem to correspond to the growth imperatives of a particular country. So, for instance, if China adds to its list of 2020 growth milestones, we might, for example, see an increase in healthcare companies being targeted. At least that's what's being asserted in the report. The other thing is that the IT industry seems to be a fairly consistently attacked industry, whereas other industries kind of have a natural ebb and flow. All right, their next point, I think, is a little more meat to it, and that's that attackers are using common business terms in their messaging and malware to convince people to open and launch some malware. So this is really the common phishing scams of around sending email from UPS or ADP or other entities claiming to be some important report or important data that needs to be looked at. And corresponding zip files continue to be the really predominant delivery mechanism. Now, I'm not entirely sure what the point behind zipping them up is, other than to say that a lot of email filters just outright block exe files, and the modus operandi of a lot of these phishing attacks is they will send a exe file inside of a zip file, and they'll do some tricky crafting to make the exe file look like a PDF. So it'll be packaged with an icon that makes it look like a PDF, and they will give it a file name, something report.pdf, and then a whole bunch of spaces, and then .exe. And hopefully the number of spaces makes it wrap off your screen and you can't actually see that there is a .exe. So you double click on it thinking you're getting a PDF, and in fact you're opening an .exe. The next point is that malware authors are starting to get a little crafty about anti-forensics and anti-malware in general. So, for instance, one of the tactics, and I think I've talked about this before, that's becoming somewhat common, is for malware or watering hole type attacks, or maybe even the malware itself, once it's on the system, is dormant unless it sees actual evidence of a human interacting with the system. So that might say, you know, that the malware doesn't actually do anything until it sees a mouse being moved. And the reason for that is the authors are trying to add a little bit of life before these things are being detected and signatures are built by the antivirus companies, so that they can actually get a little more mileage out of their investment in the malware before it starts getting caught. So a lot of these antivirus companies and security researchers have automated systems that go and try to collect stuff. And so those things might not exhibit the normal behavior of a person, like moving a mouse. And the other side of that is a lot of these pieces of malware now are becoming aware of whether or not they're being run inside a virtual machine, and actually won't do anything if they are being run in a virtual machine, because that is usually a pretty good indicator that it's being analyzed by a researcher. So that says to me, hey, there might be some legs to having people do their work inside a virtual machine. And, you know, realistically, I think that provides a number of benefits beyond just what I just mentioned. And in the name of evasion, the malware authors are relying increasingly on DLLs instead of EXEs. And the reason is that a lot of times antivirus programs are not configured to scan DLLs, or may just be generally harder to detect. So we'll see, for instance, a dropper place a DLL file and implement some kind of a package that loads the malicious DLL instead of a valid DLL. And they might do that by placing the malicious DLL in a path that gets executed or loaded before the real location of the real DLL is. There's quite a number of different tricks that can be used for loading malicious DLLs. So I think there's probably going to be a lot of legs to this trend. And you really, one more reason that we can't completely rely on antivirus as a solution to keep us safe. No matter how sophisticated antivirus gets, the malware authors are continually looking for new techniques to evade it. In a related topic, I've had a couple of discussions with colleagues and friends lately about why antivirus isn't completely effective. So when I have these discussions, it's usually pretty surprising to, you know, the layperson, even someone who is moderately intelligent when it comes to information security or IT in general, that AV can't actually catch everything. And I don't want to go into a big diatribe on AV evasion techniques here, but I would definitely tell you, if you have any question about that, just go to Google and type in antivirus evasion techniques and look at some of the results. There's a lot of opportunity here. A lot of it's being published by penetration testers, but, you know, the reality is these guys are just using techniques that the bad guys are also using. So I don't think there's anything new or surprising there, but it does give you a taste as to, you know, what's possible and why we can't, again, rely on antivirus as a strong protection against viruses. All right, the next story is from InfoWorld, and this is one of those stop the presses stories. Pay attention. We've all been doing it wrong. Just follow these two simple steps and it'll all be fine. The first step is stop users from executing malicious programs. And the second one is obviously patch everything faster. So if you do those two things, everything gets much easier in the world of security. Now, joking aside, I think they are some fairly good, if not obvious, points. Taking them in reverse order, patching everything faster is definitely good advice. It's always been good advice, and it probably will always be good advice. But it's definitely not a panacea or a savior, because, you know, we have seen repeated instances, for example, where Java is known to be vulnerable out in the wild and there's no patch. Flash is vulnerable and there's an exploit out in the wild and there's no patch. Internet Explorer, and on and on and on. So it's definitely an important component, but it isn't the end of the story. And the other is to prevent people from executing malicious programs. And I think if we could do that, our jobs would be much easier. There are some technologies that will help that. For instance, application whitelisting. But, you know, there isn't a perfect solution there. So if you can create the ideal environment where people can't execute things, that would definitely be ideal. I've really not seen an environment where that's actually practical, but I suspect there probably are some cases where it is. So everything we're left with is something that's less perfect. Now, there may be some opportunities to start pushing those things into a sandbox where people need to execute maybe questionable things, and they can do that in a contained sandbox or virtual environment. That makes a lot of sense. But I think this is elusive for many organizations and continues to be a lot of heartburn for people. All right, the next story is back to the Mandiant APT1 report. There's a new report out by a group called iTrust and malware.lu, and it's a really good read. It's much more technical, in my estimation, than the APT1 report was, and that's not a knock on the APT1 report, just a different purpose. This report really gets into some of the really gory details, and these people actually start taking a look at the command and control infrastructure, and they get in there and they take a look at some of these servers by using vulnerabilities in the Poison Ivy command and control server. So the whole report's pretty good. They have a couple of bullet points in their conclusion, which I think are worth talking about. And the first is that they see that there are more than 300 servers involved in the infrastructure. The attackers are using proxy servers to hide their activities, and I think we already knew that based on the APT1 report, so that's not really a surprise. What was a bit news to me was that this group dedicated one server per target. So I thought that was interesting. A lot of the malware that was being used by this group is custom made. The group works office hours. So one of the interesting things these guys did was actually look at the time the command and control servers were actually being managed by the attackers, and they were able to plot out their workday and their weekly schedule, and it basically looks like what you would expect to see in an office environment. And that just generally the activity or the whole endeavor is pretty organized, which again, I think Mandiant did a pretty good job of also describing. All right, the next story is about SSH, and the author of the SSH protocol, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name, is proposing a new version of the protocol. And it appears that most of the desire for changes has to do with SSH keys and kind of the mess we have in larger environments with keys just running wild. I can tell you from having managed environments where we set up SSH keys, it becomes really complicated. So passwords get changed, but usually SSH keys don't get changed. And so you end up with this kind of bad situation where you have a proliferation of people who have the ability to log into different systems. So there's in my opinion, a lot of value here. I'm not exactly sure how the problem's going to be solved. I'm really interested to see how this works out because, you know, I can definitely see and have seen firsthand how these problems manifest themselves. So the objective of this new protocol draft is actually going to be a couple of different things. Number one is moving keys to protected locations. Two is removing unused keys. Three is associating authorized keys with a business process or application. Four is removing keys for which no valid purpose can be found. Five is rotating keys. Six is restricting what can be done with each authorized key. And last is establishing a process for approving new keys. I mean, to me, it seems like a really good list, and I definitely hope they make some progress in this space. And by the way, the last time the SSH protocol was updated, which was version 2, was 2006. And I think we've definitely learned a lot since then, and IT as a whole has matured a lot since then. The next story is about the Shylock piece of malware and how it is advancing. So Shylock is a bit of banking malware that's been banging around for a while, but it continues to be updated with some new features. And recently, one of the features I find most interesting is that it gives the attacker essentially a VNC type connection to the host system. And so that's definitely a very concerning thing and has applicability far beyond just banking. So this is something that as an IT security operation, we really all need to be concerned about. Allowing an attacker to have a VNC session on a workstation inside your network is definitely not a laughing matter. All right, the next story is about porn sites serving malware. A long time ago, I remember in the early days of the internet inside organizations, porn sites were the pariahs of the internet and the source of most malware. But for quite some time, porn sites have kind of fallen away in favor of, you know, kind of other contemporary sources. And I think the reason for that is that the bad guys are really trying to find a broader set of victims than just those people who visit porn sites. But I think probably what is becoming realized by a lot of these bad guys is that porn sites are very heavily visited by people. I mean, these are some of the most popular sites on the internet that we never speak about. And so while the porn sites themselves are not directly involved in the distribution of the malware, most of them are funded by advertising. And since they're not usually able to take advantage of more mainstream, what I'll call clean ad providers, like, let's say, AdSense or some of the others, they're relegated to maybe a little more dodgy services who don't have such a problem with malvertising or providing malware inside the advertisements on their ad networks. So this particular story is about how Xhamster, which is the 46th most popular site on the internet, had malvertising on 1,067 out of 21,000 pages that were screened over the past 90 days, which works out to about 5%. I thought it was somewhat interesting or funny that the owner of the site said that, you know, we only have 0.003% of our pages serving malicious ads. And, you know, we have billions of hits per month. Well, 0.003% of billions of hits per month is still quite a lot of malware being served up. So, you know, put this in your BYOD pipe and smoke it, because, you know, this is the 46th most popular site. Your people are going to be using their personal devices to surf porn, and there's not a lot you can do about it unless you have convinced them to let you filter what they're surfing on their own personal device, which usually doesn't go over real well. So I think we're back to the point where, you know, the sites of ill repute are again becoming more dangerous. And when you combine that with, let's say, NBC.com being hacked and serving up malware, it's a pretty dangerous place out there. But clearly, there's not a lot of value in letting people use a system for that's also used for business purposes, surfing pornography. It's just too great of a risk. I mean, in my mind, letting them surf on NBC.com or ABC.com or really any non-core site to their particular job is worth the risk. And to be honest, if you have a critical business process or sensitive data or what have you, it really is just becoming too risky to do any kind of internet work on that system. I think I'm becoming a broken record on that point, so I'll let it go. And the final story for tonight is regarding the global payments breach from last year. The company's now coming out and saying that the cost of the breach is coming in at less than they had originally planned, and that the lower number is actually $93.9 million. In my book, that's still a very, very high number. It's you know, almost $100 million for losing 1.5 million credit card numbers. It is a little interesting that in the article, it says Global Payments recovered about $20 million of the losses through insurance recoveries. So that makes me wonder if they're talking about cyber insurance, and maybe it serves a purpose after all. But then again, if I were a cyber insurer, I'd probably be thinking about how I make sure my customers actually have some pretty stringent level of control. I don't think there's ever actually been a definitive answer on how the breach occurred. So, you know, we really can't say if, you know, there was actually anything they could have done to avoid it reasonably. But I think it's probably safe to say that one of the many common methods of data being lost was in play here. But, you know, we may never know for sure. So anyway, that is the show for this week. I appreciate everyone's time. The show notes and links to all the stories that I talk about are on the website, www.defensivesecurity.org. You can follow me on Twitter, @DefensiveSec. Send me emails with any suggestions or stories or ideas or criticism, help naming your kids, whatever, to info@defensivesecurity.org. If you like the podcast, I encourage you to get on iTunes and give me a rating, drop a comment in. So based on the best ability of mine to actually count how many people are downloading the podcast, there's right around 500 people pretty regularly downloading this, which is pretty good. There's been about 6,000 total downloads. I've gotten some fairly kind feedback, and I definitely appreciate that. You know, again, my goal here is to make this podcast actually beneficial. I get a lot out of it because it keeps me in the loop, reading, thinking about this stuff. But, you know, ultimately, it should be useful for you guys too. Again, if you have any ideas, anything that you'd like me to talk about, any criticism, whatever, drop me a line. I think what I'm going to do to help incent people is Richard Baitlick, who is the CSO of Mandiant, is actually going to be releasing a new book, I think in the summer, called The Practice of Network Security Monitoring, which to me sounds pretty cool. I think what I'm going to do is give away an ebook version of that. And the way I'm going to do that is, over the next, let's say, 2 weeks, I'm going to look at who's sent me email with ideas or criticisms or thoughts about the podcast, and I'll pick someone at random. So if you're interested in that free ebook, drop me a line, info@defensivesecurity.org. Anyhow, it's way past my bedtime, and I am here in New York at a conference this week, and I have to get up pretty early to get my workout in before the conference starts. So I will cut it off here. I hope everyone has a great week, and I will talk to you all later. Have a good one. Bye.